All right, thank you. While you all are getting your seats, let me take the liberty to mention something that Dick did not mention. I love teaching politics, but I've become more and more involved in George Fox University's new Great Books Honors program. It's a very intensive program that replaces the regular general education package for students at George Fox. So I know we have a few young people here. If you love to read and love to read great texts, might be something you want to look at. But if you all are parents or grandparents of students like this, I hope you'll put them in contact with me, and I do have a few brochures from the program back there. All right, so what I propose to do now, we're moving slowly but surely to issues of religious liberty, church-state relations, and we'll get there eventually, and then tomorrow we'll spend all day there, including talking about current controversies over religious liberty and same-sex wedding ceremonies and that sort of thing. Let me begin with what might at least first glance seem to be another sort of broad esoteric topic. It's a question. I think it's a fun question. Did America have a Christian founding? One of the reasons it's sort of fun, I think, is because you can look at the literature on this and break it into two major categories. One is literature written by popular Christian authors. And so I have in mind here people like, like Tim LaHaye, Peter Marshall, David Manuel, Gary Amos, and others. David Barton would fall into that category. I usually don't mention him in this context because he's been so pilloried by some critics that I sort of don't want to be seen to be piling on to this. He is nowhere near as bad as they say he is. I'll say that for sure. But as an academic, when I read these popular Christian accounts of religion in the American founding, they do tend to be a bit too optimistic. Under these accounts, almost everyone is an Orthodox, pious Christian. Usually sometimes willing to say, well, maybe Thomas Jefferson late in life went off the reservation. But they are a bit uncritical. Oftentimes these authors don't follow scholarly conventions. They use, I think mistakenly, made-up quotes, or they quote things out of context and whatnot. So it's way too often, of course it's so obvious we had this great, glorious, and grand Christian founding, and that's it. So these are the popular Christian authors. I've already told you a bit about the academic authors that take almost the exact opposite approach. No, of course we didn't. The founders were deists who desired the strict separation of church and state. They drew from the liberal Enlightenment ideas from a John Locke, from a Montesquieu, and Christianity, they might have been Christians, they might have gone to church, but really Christianity wasn't important. So you have almost these two poles that are out there. And what I want to do then is I want to dive into this issue and begin by suggesting, again, in terms of how we might think critically about this sort of question, one of the very first things you have to do, I think, is tear into the question and say, okay, what exactly do we mean? What would a Christian founding look like? It's an important question, right? We have to know what it would look like if we were to determine whether or not we have one. So what I propose to do is interrogate this question and then make an argument, and I'll not tell you where the argument will come out quite yet, but then we'll look at some religious liberty and church-state issues at the end. So I think the first thing that we really have to do is define what a Christian founding would look like, okay? That is the adjective here, I guess, Christian. What sort of evidence would we look for? Now, I want to throw out a couple of different possible answers and suggest whether I think this is a good way to approach it or a bad way to approach it. We could say simply, were the American founders, would they have identified themselves as Christians? And the answer to that is absolutely. About 99.9% of white Americans in this era were Christians. There's maybe 5,000 Jews in America. That's probably a high estimate in five cities. Everyone else would have said, I am a Christian. Moreover, about 98% would have said, I am a Protestant. You have some Catholics in Maryland and elsewhere, but actually not very many. We sometimes speak loosely of Maryland as a Catholic colony. I don't think Maryland was ever a majority Catholic colony. And eventually the Catholics lost power and the Anglican Church was established in Maryland. But definitely all these white Americans, and notice I limit myself to white Americans, Native Americans, African Americans are a different story, but certainly of white Americans, those sorts of Americans that were participating in the war for independence and the state legislatures and drafting constitutions, they would have identified themselves as Christians. But I would say, so what? That's not really that interesting, okay, that they would identify themselves as Christians. Well, we might want to take that a step further then and say, well, okay, were they really Christians? Were they sincere about their faith? Did they mean it, right? Now, this is a bit more interesting, and this would be good to know, maybe, but it's almost impossible for the historian to know. We can know certain things about them, that they identified themselves as a Congregationalist, that they joined an Anglican church, that they served as a deacon, that they went to church. We can know some of these things, but of course that tells us very little about their heart, right, and their relationship with God. Similarly, and this is somewhat relatedly, we could ask, were they Orthodox Christians? Someone like Thomas Jefferson was happy to call himself a Christian, right? But was he really a Christian? Did he embrace a traditional Orthodox Christian beliefs? This is something we can know in some cases from the evidence. Just no one disputes that Roger Sherman was an Orthodox Christian and even a good Calvinist. In many cases, though, believe it or not, it's really hard to know. A lot of founders didn't leave a lot of papers. They purposely destroyed private papers, and so we just simply don't know. One popular definition that's usually used to say America didn't have a Christian founding is to ask, did the founders act like Christians, or did they embrace political positions that the Christian faith would lead them to embrace? So orthopraxy, this is sometimes called. So you might look at someone like Alexander Hamilton and say, well, Alexander Hamilton had an affair, therefore he's not an Orthodox Christian or a good Christian, or therefore America didn't have a Christian founding because he did this sort of thing and other people did similar sort of things. I think this is just a lame argument. It's kind of a silly argument. Of course, one could be even a sincere Orthodox Christian and do a grave sin of that nature. A related argument is something like this. While we all know that Christianity is against slavery, the American founders didn't immediately abolish slavery, so therefore they didn't take their Christian commitment seriously. Well, this is just a horrible historical argument. It's a sin. It's almost literally an academic sin of presentivism, right? And this is when we take ideas that just seem so commonplace to us and assume that people 250 years ago have to share those, or they aren't sincere about their faith. Without going into a long debate, I'll point out it's not crystal clear that the Bible condemns slavery, right? Slaves are told to obey their master. Onesimus is sent back by Paul to his master Philemon. There were some Christians were troubled by this in the era. There were arguments that were beginning to be made about it. But to say that because the founders didn't abolish slavery, they weren't Orthodox Christians, would be as bad as, 200 years from now, it might become patently obvious that Obamacare is obviously the best thing ever that any Christian who cares about the poor, weak, and dispossessed should have supported. But from 200 years ago, to look back and say people who didn't support Obamacare weren't sincere Christians, and that's obviously just a problematic argument, right? You and I know from having lived through these debates, you can have very sincere Christians on both sides of these questions that are trying to struggle through and figure out how do we actually help the least well-off and so forth. People of goodwill can disagree. So I think these orthopraxy arguments are highly, highly problematic. The fifth way to think about this is actually the one that I'm going to suggest is the best way. Were the founders, can we come up with good reasons for believing the founders were influenced by Christian ideas? So this gets us a little bit away from having to judge their hearts, to judge, did they really mean it or not? It also has the benefit of falling in with a lot of academic literature on the founding. Book after book has been published arguing that the founders were influenced by Lockean liberalism, the Scottish Enlightenment, the classical Republican tradition. And so in the same way, I think we could ask the question, do we have good reasons to believe that the founders were influenced by Christian ideas? All right, so that's how I'm going to approach the question, and we'll see how it comes out. Now, the second part of that of our definitional problem is, when was America founded? If we have some notion of what a Christian founding looks like, we want to see these people being influenced by Christian ideas. we now have to say, when was America founded? I want to suggest there are three obvious categories, candidates for this. The first are the earliest colonial settlements. If we think of America, we probably don't want to necessarily start thinking just in terms of 1770s. We might look at these earliest settlements, how they developed over time. We broke from Great Britain, we wrote a constitution, and went on forward, right? So we could begin with the earliest colonial settlements. But a second possibility is 1776, Declaration of Independence, breaking from Great Britain, because we were, after all, British colonies prior to 1776, right? But you might ask, what came of the Declaration of Independence? And probably the best answer is 13 independent states. We aren't a coherent nation yet. And someone might point to the U.S. Constitution as a third possible founding moment to say America was founded in 1789, let's say. All right, so if we have that as our approach, let's begin with the earliest colonial settlements. Now, everyone agrees that the settlers in New England were profoundly motivated by their religious convictions, right? That they came to America so that they could create these godly commonwealths and practice their faith as they understood it. So I'm not even going to spend any time on the Pilgrims or the Puritans or that sort of thing, because I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But what about the rest of the colonies? If you listen to a lot of historians, a very common way to describe this period of American history is to say the Puritans came to New England for God, the Southerners came here for gold. There was commercial motivations, right? This is why they were here. And when they didn't find gold, thank goodness they found tobacco, and that became sort of a new form of gold. And so it was commercial motivations. Well, let me suggest that, again, with all these things, there's true, and I hope you will never hear me say simply, well, it's obviously all one thing. History can be complicated for sure. Just to focus on Virginia a little bit, the first legal code of Virginia, 1610 legal code, begins like this. I'm going to quote it here. Whereas His Majesty, like himself, a most zealous prince, has in his own realms a principal care of true religion and reverence to God, and has always strictly commanded his generals and governors with all his forces wheresoever to let their ways be like his ends for the glory of God. The first three articles then go on to require church attendance to offer penalties for people who would blaspheme God or the Trinity, the penalty of death for these sorts of things. The southern colonies, I want to suggest then, were not just commercial ventures without any concern with true Christianity or converting the Indians. There was plenty of this going on as well. What about Pennsylvania? I teach at George Fox University. Hopefully you recognize the name. George Fox is a founder of the Quakers. Pennsylvania, of course, a Quaker colony. And so you might say, well, that's going to be significantly different, right? I want to suggest that it is maybe not quite as different as we might think. You read through the Charters of Liberty and the frame of government of the province of Pennsylvania. They're riffed with theological and even biblical language. Romans 13 is paraphrased. You wouldn't recognize, they don't have the citation, but if you know it, you'd recognize it. Let me read you one of my favorite provisions of the Pennsylvania Charter, Article 37. Listen to some things that the government will be involved with doing. The government will punish, quote, offenses against God, such as swearing, cursing, lying, profane talking, drunkenness, obscene words, incest, sodomy, stage plays, cards, dice, May games, gamesters, mass, revels, bull baiting, cockfighting, bear baiting, and the like, which excite the people to rudeness, cruelty, looseness, and irreligion. Pennsylvania had religious tests for office. Pennsylvania protected religious liberty well, but clearly favored initially Quakers and then certainly Christians in all things. 9 of 13 colonies had established churches and all had religious tests for office of one sort or another. So what am I saying? First of all, do you hear me as saying that I think these are all good things? No, I'm not. What I would say, though, is I think you can find, and of course I'm just skimming the surface of evidence and would want to go a lot deeper, but you can find a lot of great evidence that the men and women who settled our early colonies were intentionally trying to create Christian commonwealths. And so certainly if that's what we're looking to, you could say, yeah, America had a Christian founding. It becomes a little more difficult, though, and let me just throw this, I love discussing this question with my students. because my students are mostly evangelicals, and they're mostly patriotic Americans as well. And so I'll ask the question in this way, doesn't the war for independence fly in the face of Romans 13? I mean, Romans 13 sort of seems to say that you shouldn't rebel against political authority. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appropriated, appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist bring judgment on themselves. So at least on the surface, there would seem to be a tension there, and we have to recognize this, and we can debate it. I have a political scientist who teaches down at the Master's College in California. He and I have debated this several times in public forums. He believes that American war for independence was absolutely unjust, that it was absolutely a violation of Romans 13. I take the other side, and we have a good debate. How can you make that case in light of Romans 13? Well, for many years, Christians didn't. Christians would say, look, you don't obey a command to worship Baal or something like that, but you don't have the authority to resist the state. Around the 12th century, some people, some Christian thinkers started to say, well, maybe Romans 13 is talking about a good government, not a tyranny. All right? The Protestants picked this up and ran with it like there was no tomorrow. John Calvin, I already mentioned, was the most conservative of the Calvinists. John Knox, writing at the same time as Calvin, is saying, no, the people themselves can rise up in revolution. And you have this long list of reformed political thinkers: John Knox, George Buchanan, Samuel Rutherford, Stephanus Junius Brutus, Theodore Beza, Christopher Goodman, John Poney, and others, who are arguing pretty robustly. These are all Calvinists, incidentally, and they have this robust theory of resistance, that it is a necessity for Christians to resist ungodly tyrants. Now, again, this becomes so important in the American context because up to 75% of Americans are reasonably classified as Calvinists. So they're growing up with these sorts of arguments and, indeed, these sorts of people. Again, I want to emphasize that these folks, not all of them, but most of them, were writing well before John Locke wrote the Second Treatise. John Locke is the son of a Puritan. So I think he's actually best understood as working within this tradition, developing it somewhat, and certainly articulating it in a way that became important later on. The war for independence was recognized, I was already hinting at this, as something connected with this. Here's a famous political cartoon, which you can't hardly see, I know, but I'll explain to you why it's interesting. One of the great fears, we don't hear about this fear much, one of the great fears of the colonists was that the British government was going to send a bishop to America and create ecclesiastical courts and crack down on these Protestants. And so the image here is of a bishop who's been sent over and the Americans chasing him off. You can see they're throwing different books at him. The one that's about to hit the bishop in the head that you can maybe see there, it's Calvin's Works. All right, so using John Calvin to get this dang bishop out of the way. The loyalist Peter Oliver railed against the Black Regiment, the dissenting clergy who took so active a part in the rebellion. And I already mentioned King George is reported to have referred to the War for Independence as the Presbyterian Rebellion. On a normative plane, I would want to suggest you look at something like the Declaration of Independence. It is relying, as Dick pointed out, we didn't coordinate on this, on a theological claim, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, some people, they do this all the time. It drives me crazy. They say, well, Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration, and we know that he's a heretic, and by nature's God, he means nature, and so forth. That may actually be the case for Jefferson. I won't even argue with you about that, but I'll say Jefferson, although he penned the Declaration of Independence, he was not the only person involved. You had this committee of five. And let me just give you a brief telling story about Roger Sherman. 1776, there are three congressional committees that we look back on and say these were pretty important. The committee to draft the Declaration of Independence, the committee to draft the Articles of Confederation, and the Board of War, which was probably the most important at the time, right? That's actually directing our fight against Great Britain. Thomas Jefferson, young Thomas Jefferson, was put on one of these committees, the committee to write the Declaration of Independence. John Adams, I think, was on two. John Dickinson was on two. There was only one person on all three, Roger Sherman, the old Puritan from Connecticut. So Sherman, who's the big boy, one of the big boys here, is on this committee of five, writing the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson drafted it. The committee changed it. Then Congress changed it. When we're looking at the Declaration of Independence, I think we have to understand it's a product of a community, not just Thomas Jefferson. I'm not trying to take anything away from Thomas Jefferson, just this is the way politics works, and we need to understand this. Very seldom is a legislature just completely blown away by one person who gets to dictate his will and who has everything go his way, and that certainly was the case with these patriots. All right, so I think we can make, I'm pretty comfortable, and I do some of this in the Sherman book, making a good argument that Christianity, Christian ideas, ideas derived from Christian political thinkers had a real impact on the war for independence, the patriot cause, and so forth. So I think you can say even that had important and profound Christian motivations. What about the Constitution? Then this does create a problem. You read through the Constitution, and at first glance, it appears godless, right? Basically, God, a clear reference to the deity, doesn't appear until the very last line in the year of our Lord, 1787. Moreover, there's elements of the Constitution that seem to cut against the idea that America had a Christian founding. There's a prohibition on religious tests for office, right? That's not very cool, at least arguably. You do have this assumption that Congress won't be doing business on Sunday, so the pocket veto occurs 10 days after a piece of legislation is passed, Sunday accepted. But on the other hand, you have this First Amendment that prohibits an establishment of religion. And so scholars have argued. Isaac Kramnik and R. Lawrence Moore have argued that we have a godless Constitution. All right, so what are we to make of this claim? This is an interesting claim because if America then was founded with this Constitution, you could say, yeah, fine, these early colonists were godly people trying to create Christian commonwealths. Maybe the patriots had were motivated by Christianity and Christian ideas. But the United States of America was actually founded as a secular republic, as evidenced by the Constitution. There's a lot of these state constitutions would have great and grand and glorious references to God and morality and this sort of thing in their preambles and elsewhere. The Constitution doesn't. Why not? What's going on here? I wouldn't make the argument along the following lines. I think that you could make a very strong argument that the founders were influenced by Christian ideas. They don't mention much about the role of government in promoting religion or morality in the U.S. Constitution because almost to a person, Federalist, Anti-Federalist, whatnot, they were committed to the idea that the national government was going to be one of very limited powers. To the extent to which government should promote religion or morality, this would be done at the state government level, or local governments even. So we just aren't going to go down that road. Read Article 1, Section 8 if you want to know what the founders thought government would do. And even that, of course, is too much power to the national government for some anti-federalists. All right, so how do you go about making this argument? Well, one way is you can look and make it broadly. I have a friend, Barry Allen Chain, who makes a great argument, the myth of American individualism, the Protestant origins of American political thought, where he argues for these theological influences upon America's founders. He himself is not a believer, so he's not someone arguing for his team, so to speak. He's just a good scholar that has found this. An interesting study that's often cited, and I think quite useful, a fellow named Donald Lutz went through political literature in this era and documented what these guys were actually citing, clearly citing. Let me tell you the punchline, I guess. So when you look at what these guys are citing when they're making their political arguments, the Bible comes up, number one, by far and away, 34%. You take all the works out of the Enlightenment collectively, John Locke, Montesquieu, and others, and they're a distant second at 22%, Whig, Common Law, Classical, and others. So these guys are citing the Bible all the time. This count actually undercounts biblical citations because he excludes from his study political pamphlets and arguments and sermons that don't cite secular thinkers as well as the Bible. All right, so this is sort of the broad brush approach, and you can try to make this argument. A different path that I've gone down with some colleagues is to try to look at as many individual founders as possible. Now, this can be long work. So I have a book on Roger Sherman, a book on James Wilson, and I suggest these are two incredibly important founders, probably ones you haven't heard of, at least most Americans haven't. But tomorrow we'll talk a little about Roger Sherman, and hopefully you'll say, wow, this guy really was pretty important, and we should know more about him. And it raises interesting questions as to why we don't know more about him. So I can do some of this, but I can only do so much. So one of the things I've done with a couple of friends is we've edited three different books and are working on some others where we've profiled something like 30 American founders in different traditions and whatnot. And what you find is when you get away from this Franklin, Jefferson, and even Madison to some extent, and you start looking at the broader constellation of founders, you can find some really good evidence that these were people who took their faith seriously, who were drawing from Christian ideas, who were incorporating Scripture in their arguments, and who I think you can make a good idea, that they a good argument that they were, in fact, influenced by their Christian commitments. Let me just give you, I could go on and on, you could read the books if you want, but let me give you a couple of clear ways that I think this is the case. First and foremost, they were convinced that men were sinful, all right? As you might expect Christians in general, and particularly Calvinists, to be, right? Men are sinful. Even Christians are struggling with the old man within. This led them to avoid the utopian experiments, such as went on in the French Revolution, where you have an optimistic view of human nature. It is telling. People sometimes flippantly say, well, the founders were influenced by the Enlightenment. What was Enlightenment political thought teaching at the time? Basically, that humans are basically good, that what we need is government by the educated elite, and that, you know, through the proper sorts of laws, we can make everyone good and enter some sort of utopia. The American founders would have none of this, right? If men were angels, government wouldn't be necessary, says James Madison. But men aren't angels, so therefore we need a system that carefully constrains power, checks and balances, separation of powers, federalism. We need to do whatever we can to prevent corruption within this system. All right, so humans were sinful, therefore this informs lots of our constitutional structures. They firmly believed that God had created moral standards, natural laws, that had to be followed. If you read through James Wilson, I mentioned him, a real important American founder, involved in writing and signing both the Declaration and the Constitution, an early Supreme Court justice, gave the first long series of lectures on American law. When you read through this, he sounds like Thomas Aquinas in parts. There are two types of law, human law, divine law. Of divine law, there are four types, the eternal law, the celestial law, natural moral laws, and natural physical laws, and natural moral laws. Human laws must be based upon moral law, or they are not valid laws. An unjust law is no law at all, says St. Thomas Aquinas. This idea is just everywhere among the American founders. Every single justice, except with one exception prior to John Marshall, is on record as saying the U.S. Supreme Court could strike down an act of Congress if it violated the natural law. Now, that's a striking claim. Just think about that. So not the Constitution, but natural law. It could strike down an act of Congress. Number three, liberty. We get all confused sometimes, I think, when we read these documents out of the American founding, and it has some stuff we kind of like, freedom of speech, freedom of press. Well, how do we apply that today? How do we apply it to issues of pornography? For the American founders, it was a no-brainer. They had a very Christian definition of liberty, basically the freedom or lack of restraints to do what is right. The American founders, to a person, distinguished between liberty and licentiousness. So to say you have a right to publish pornography, this would have just been incomprehensible to the American founders. Now, I'm a pretty big free speech guy, so I'm not necessarily trying to write policy on the fly here, but just from a historical perspective, take my word for it, liberty has to be understood as being constrained by moral standards, and it could be constrained by other standards. There is never a right to do something that is morally wrong. Finally, I'll mention the idea that humans are created in the image of God. This is why we have the ability to reason, why we have the ability to govern each other. This idea was beginning to penetrate the Americans' heads at the time with respect to slavery. Gosh, if we're all created in the image of God, how can one human own another human? And we already have abolitionists up and running, and of course they're motivated and, you know, working at this. Not as quickly as we would want. We would want them to abolish slavery right away. They didn't. But it is telling a number of states, something like 7 or 8 states, did abolish slavery voluntarily between 1776 and the early 19th century because people were figuring this out, that we're imagers of God and therefore we can't own one another. All right, so the argument would be then up to this point that I think you can make a very good argument that the American founders were influenced in important ways by Christian ideas. Not only or solely by this, right? They're pulling some ideas from the common law and elsewhere, but I think you can make a very valid argument that they were influenced by these Christian ideas. All right, but what about, it was asked earlier, what about the separation of church and state? Isn't this evidence that we didn't have a Christian founding, that somehow this church was viewed as being highly problematic? The U.S. Supreme Court, I referenced earlier, has been clearly on board, and we'll talk about this a good bit more tomorrow, on saying we have to interpret the religion clauses of the First Amendment in light of the founders' views. In Everson versus the Board of Education, 1947, both the majority and the dissent said, we absolutely have to do this. And moreover, Jefferson and Madison are the founders that matter. Jefferson and Madison wanted the strict separation of church and state. Therefore, we have the strict separation of church and state. I want to suggest, just real briefly to kind of give us an overview, and then tomorrow will be mostly 20th, 21st century stuff, to look at what the founders actually believed on these sorts of matters. And I think what we'll see is that what they believed was profoundly influenced by their Christian convictions. It wasn't any sort of distrust of religion. It wasn't any sort of fear of religion. All right, so let's begin the story with James Madison. James Madison is tasked in Virginia by the Virginia Convention to write a Bill of Rights. Critically, in this Bill of Rights, he has a famous Article 16 of the Virginia Declaration of Rights that involves religion, the protection of religion. Listen to how this reads, and note the argument that is made, that as religion, or the duty which we owe to our divine and omnipotent Creator, and the manner of discharging it can be governed only by reason and conviction, not force, we ought to have religious toleration. What I wanted to emphasize there is the beginning, that religion, or the duty that we owe to our divine and omnipotent Creator. Religious liberty is a result of the duty we have to worship God. As it's a result of an obligation. The argument makes no sense if you don't believe in the existence of God. There's no duty to worship God, therefore there's no religious liberty, according to this argument. One might make other arguments, but according to this one. Now, this was pretty good, but did you notice I ended with religious toleration? This is where direction some of our political leaders want to take us today. A book recently was published on Why Tolerate Religion. Religious toleration means, well, we'll kind of put up with you. And some people are even questioning that. Should we even put up with religious liberty at all? Religious toleration is a weak way of phrasing religious liberty. Young James Madison, in his first public act, he stood up and he said, I object to the way Mr. Mason is framing this. Religious liberty is a natural right, and therefore we should say it's a natural right. That we have a right to worship God according to the dictates of conscience. Not, this is something the state will kind of let us do when it wants to. And so the Article 16 was changed, religious toleration language was taken out, and it was clear that religious liberty is a right that we all have. By the end of the founding era, every single state constitution had this sort of provision in it, making it clear that religious liberty is a right that the state cannot infringe upon. The U.S. Constitution did not have such an amendment originally, but of course this was because the founders thought that the state, the national government, simply couldn't interfere with religion, but the anti-federalists still weren't satisfied, so they added the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion or restricting the free exercise thereof. All right, so religious liberty is a top priority for the American founders. Almost everyone's against it, or everyone's for it. No one's against it. And by and large, I think it's driven by religious convictions. Even something like the Memorial and Remonstrance, if you read through this, Madison makes a lot of explicitly Christian arguments in favor of religious liberty. Well, what about establishments? Now, this is, again, it's very common to my students to say if something's a good thing, the government should do it, right? And preferably the national government. So if education's a good thing, then obviously you should have public schools and you should have more public schools. Well, these arguments are better-funded public schools. These arguments went on in the American founding, but with respect to religion. So some people said, look, religion's really important, Christianity's really important, therefore the state should be involved in funding it. Listen to one argument. I really like this argument because it's very similar to an argument often made by public sector unions today. A petition from Westmoreland County. Actually, I want to quote from one, then we'll get to the other one. Two petitions. I found these in the Virginia State Library. It was just great. I was going through them, looking at microfiche, not the original. But there was two petitions from the same county that arrived on the same day in Virginia, where they were debating Patrick Henry's general assessment bill. The first petition, it basically said this. Religion is so very important. By religion, they meant Christianity. It's so very important that we have to have state funding to support it. Because if we don't have state funding, clergy won't be paid enough, and therefore the best and the brightest young men will go into other professions. They'll go and become attorneys or doctors or things like that, right? So we have to have state subsidy of religion. I mean, we hear these sort of arguments today, right, about public school teachers or about public health or whatever else. So they are not new arguments. But listen to the response. So here's a petition from the against the general assessment. The argument began by saying assessments are against the spirit of the gospel, that the holy author of our religion, that is Jesus Christ, did not require state support. And it actually went on to make the broad historical argument that when Constantine embraced Christianity, that was sort of the beginning of the corruption of Christianity. We don't want the state to control Christianity. And then the petition goes on to address this argument about having to pay clergy in order to get the best men. They said, look, clergy should manifest to the world that they're inwardly moved by the Holy Ghost to take upon them that office, that they seek the good of mankind and not worldly interest. Let their doctrine be scriptural, let their in their lives upright. Then shall religion, if departed, speedily return, and deism be put to open shame and its dreaded consequences removed. So we don't want state funding of religion because it will lead to people who want to become clergy because you get paid money, and that's a bad motivation, right? We want people who are moved by the Holy Spirit, and if we embrace this lack of establishment, then we will put deism to shame. I've already mentioned Madison and Memorial Remonstrance has several arguments along these same lines. Now you might object. You might say, well, look, Hall, obviously Madison's just making these religious arguments because he thinks they'll be effective, to which I would say that makes my point, right? He knew these arguments would be effective. No one was arguing religion's a bad thing, so therefore government shouldn't fund it. The argument always was, look, the state shouldn't be involved with these establishments or in other ways because it hurts true Christianity. There were still founders who believed establishments were a good thing, who argued for them. Usually by this era, it was a multiple establishment. That is, you were taxed to support the church you attended, which is far less offensive than taxing Baptists to support Anglican churches. I'm not necessarily in favor of that, but it's a tolerant, a mild sort of establishment. But in any case, these evangelicals, incidentally, tended to be some of the greatest opponents of establishments, particularly in the South. All right, well, let me conclude then. So the argument so far is religious liberty, a thoroughly Christian endeavor, I think. Again, you could support it for Enlightenment reasons. Maybe Jefferson did. But this is a small intellectual minority. The foot soldiers for this battle for religious liberty are coming from evangelicals and others. With respect to establishments, I think this, by and large, the opposition to establishments are being driven by Christianity. The last issue is, what about this wall of separation between church and state? What about this idea to get religion out of the public square? You hear this all the time, right? That religion doesn't belong in the public square. Doesn't this come out of the American founding? And as was referenced earlier, maybe a little bit, but certainly not from the U.S. Constitution, which says nothing to this sort. Thomas Jefferson, you all are aware, penned in 1802 a letter to a Baptist association in Danbury, Connecticut. In this letter, he suggests that the First Amendment Establishment Clause creates a wall of separation between church and state. So that's where this language comes from in the American context. Roger Williams said something similar 100 so years beforehand, but it really wasn't known in America. A couple of other folks, Richard Hooker and whatnot, had used this language earlier. So Jefferson didn't invent a wall of separation between church and state. These other people, particularly someone like Hooker, used that language but thought it was a horrible idea. Of course, we don't want a wall of separation between church and state. We want close cooperation. Jefferson, on the other hand, is clearly an opponent of establishments, and he finds this a useful metaphor to suggest, look, the church should be over here, the state should be over here, and obviously no support. Well, that's an interesting metaphor, but what are we to make of this? Let me begin by just pointing out an inconvenient truth for those that think the Establishment Clause requires a wall of separation between church and state, and that is Jefferson wasn't involved in writing the First Amendment. He wasn't even in America at the time, right? He was over in Europe, wasn't involved in the ratification process. So one could reasonably ask, why are we asking what he thinks? Why do we even care what he thinks? He wasn't involved with this. We had a first Congress. We should look at what these guys think. But let me go further and say it's not clear to me, at least in practice, that this wall metaphor actually reflects what Jefferson did himself. So as governor of Virginia, in the very same set of laws where he came up with his Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, he also drafted a bill saying when the governor could appoint days of public fasting and humiliation, and a separate bill for punishing dissenters of religious worship and Sabbath breakers. That's sort of interesting. When he was a member of Congress, he proposed this. You can hopefully make that out. This is Thomas Jefferson's idea of what our national seal should be like. So the image is that of Moses extending his hand over the sea, causing it to overwhelm Pharaoh. And the motto that Jefferson thought we should have for the United States of America, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. He closed his second inaugural address by encouraging all Americans to join him in seeking the favor of that being in whose hands we were, who led our forefathers as Israel of old. Now here's what becomes particularly fun. 2 days after Jefferson penned this letter to the Danbury Baptist, he went to church services in the U.S. Capitol building, where he heard John Leland, the great Baptist itinerant minister and himself an opponent of establishments, preach the sermon. Now, this should be striking. Again, if a wall of separation means anything, surely it means you shouldn't be having church services on government property or doing things of this nature, right? So whatever Jefferson meant by this when he penned it later, he looked throughout his political life, and this is certainly not how he led his political life. Now, you might be saying, okay, Hall, what are you just trying to turn everything around backwards and upside down? Are you saying that Jefferson wanted a close cooperation between church and state? No, he didn't. If I had to make a list of founders and put them on a scale of wanting a stricter separation of church and state and a close cooperation between church and state, Jefferson and Madison definitely would be on this end of the spectrum. They wanted a greater separation of church and state than most of the American founders. But I would remind you, there were a lot of American founders, particularly a lot of founders that had a lot more to do with the First Amendment. I could make this point in a variety of ways. Let me just simply do it by suggesting one obvious place to start is the First Federal Congress. If we're concerned with the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, right? It's the First Federal Congress that drafted this amendment. What can we tell from them? When we look to the First Federal Congress, we see one of the first things they did was they agreed to hire and pay chaplains. They reauthorized the Northwest Ordinance that says, in effect, that religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary for good government, the happiness of mankind in schools shall be encouraged in the territories. One particularly fun fact, I think, anyway. So the day after, I think it's the day after, the House approved the final wording of the Bill of Rights. Okay, so they have just written the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Originally the Third Amendment, but the first two didn't get ratified, so it became the First Amendment. But anyway, they just did this language, all right? Elias Boudinot stands up, and he says, hey, guys, I have a great idea. Things are going pretty well for us. Why don't we ask George Washington to issue a call for prayer and fasting? Now, Adonais Burke of South Carolina says, oh, no, we can't do that. That's a European practice. Roger Sherman, our Connecticut Puritan, that's using the word a little anachronistically, but a serious elder in his church, Calvinist, whatnot. He got up and he said, no, no, don't worry, Ananias. And he justified the practice. Here I'm quoting from the newspaper account of this. He justified the practice of thanksgiving on any single event, not only is laudable in itself, but is warranted by a number of precedents from in Holy Writ. For instance, the solemn thanksgivings and rejoicing which took place in the time of Solomon after the building of the temple was a case in point. He thought this example worthy of Christian imitation on the present occasion. You see what Sherman's doing? He's saying, no, it's okay. We can have calls for prayer and fasting because it's a biblical thing. And he went to the Bible to find evidence to support this. Well, the House agrees with Sherman and his buddy. The Senate agrees with the House. They then ask. They don't tell. They ask George Washington, would you please issue this call for prayer, in this case, Thanksgiving? And he did. Listen to parts of this. President still issued the calls for presidential Thanksgiving Day proclamations and throughout history, other sorts of calls for prayer as well. You read them today, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and they're both hopelessly bland, right? Kind of think good thoughts and pray if you want to. Listen to George Washington. So this is a father of our nation, the first president of the United States. Whereas it is a duty of all nations. Note that duty again. We have a duty to worship God. Whereas it is a duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Let me emphasize as well, do you know that it's a duty of nations, not just individuals within the nations. This was a very common sentiment. To obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and to humbly implore his protections and favor, I do recommend the people of these states to the service of the great and glorious being who is a beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. And also that we may then unite in humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations and beseech him to pardon our national and other transgressions. I love that line. I mean, it's real easy to say, God, please bless us. Hooray, hooray for us. But no, he's saying, look, we as a nation have sinned and we need to beg God to forgive us of these sins. And so he goes on to encourage them to do that. Now, these proclamations were regularly issued by presidents. Again, they still are today. Jefferson, it's true, didn't do it. He thought there was either First or Tenth Amendment problems with it, but most everyone did. So what is the point I'm trying to make here? The point is almost no American thought there should be an exile of religion from the public square. Not even Thomas Jefferson or James Madison, but you get beyond them and you look at your Roger Shermans, your George Washingtons, your John Adams, and I can go on and on and on. And there's almost no sentiment to support this idea that there should be a wall of separation between church and state, a strict separation of church and state. It's just not in the American founding. It's a horrible historical argument to say that it is. You might want to argue for it based on public policy considerations or something like that. But to say that this is what the American founders wanted, just absolutely false. All right, so did America have a Christian founding? Hopefully I've suggested ways in which we should think about this question. I have a long conclusion written, but it's 9 o'clock, so I'm just going to simply say, I think it's obvious if you have to choose between a yes and a no, the obvious answer is yes, America had a Christian founding. But in saying that, you'd want to be very careful and explain what you mean by that and offer some of the sort of evidence that I've attempted to offer. All right, so it's 9 o'clock. I imagine people are tired, but I wonder, should we take a few questions or objections? Is that permissible?
Objections.
Usually when I give this talk, I get a lot of objections.
Before we do, because I know there's people that aren't going to be here tomorrow, will you talk about your two books for just a minute?
Okay, real quickly, the book I've referenced several times is Roger Sherman and the Creation of the American Republic. Sherman is just intimately involved in every important national issue that you can think of in the American founding, from the Declaration of Independence to the Articles of Confederation to the U.S. Constitution to the Bill of Rights. He's there. He's influential. And I think he represents well these many Americans who were reformed in nature. And so this is a book you can get on Amazon easily enough, Roger Sherman, The Creation of the American Republic. This is...
We have it for sale in the back.
That's probably a better way, for sale in the back. This is an absolutely great resource. This huge book sells for $15. It's published by Liberty Fund Press, which is all about making books concerning liberty available to the public. This is a huge collection of primary source documents. So this is almost all primary source, almost any document you would conceivably want to read with respect to religious liberty, church-state relations, from the colonies to the early 19th century, you can find here. So this is a nice resource. The title is The Sacred Rights of Conscience.
Quick question, Dr. Hall. Thomas Jefferson's Quran, the one that Keith Ellison took his oath of Congress on, you have one side that says he was very tolerant of Islamic religion, and then another side that says he wanted to understand his enemy due to the Barbary pirate situation. What's your take?
Okay, so Thomas Jefferson on Islam, is that a fair way of putting the question? Yeah, there. I just reviewed a book written by a very prominent scholar on this question who tried to make a lot more of this than I think can be made. Jefferson did own a copy of the Quran, which now is owned by the Library of Congress, and the first Islamic member of Congress elected a few years ago took his oath of office on this Quran. I think it's a case there's little evidence that he read the Quran. He clearly thought that Islam was a barbaric religion. But he also thought Calvinism was a barbaric religion and Judaism was a barbaric religion. I mean, he was a very, very harsh. The only religion he liked was this sort of warm, fuzzy Unitarianism, deism. He famously predicted in the early 19th century that not a young man today will die before all of America has become Unitarian. Completely false, right? This just never went anywhere, really, in the American context. Yes, I would say he might have been somewhat familiar. It's not clear how much he knew. Jefferson is, he's a fighter. When it came to these Barbary pirates that were preying on American shipping, John Adams says, let's pay them off. We don't want to get into a war with them. Thomas Jefferson says, let's send in the Marines and clean them up, which they did on the shores of Tripoli. So he was such a well-read person, it wouldn't surprise me if he was reading the Quran to try to get up to speed so he could maybe understand these enemies of the American people better. But he certainly did not have tolerant opinions of Islam.
Yes, Dr. Hall, how do you respond to those who say that original intent is irrelevant, that it makes no difference what the founding fathers believed because society is changing, mores are changing, Constitution is an evolving document, and that you can't rule a country on a document written in the 1700s with people who didn't know about the internet and you know what's going on today, and then just the diversity where, like I say, we've been told we're no longer a Christian nation, and we've got, you know, Muslims coming in, different people coming in, so we have to we have to respect their beliefs.
Sure. That's a great question, a multi-pronged question. Let me begin with just a comment of your last comment. I think absolutely we should respect their beliefs. We should respect the beliefs of all Americans, atheists, Christians, Jews, and whatnot. That's sort of been the genius of religious liberty in America, as we've always said. Religious liberty isn't just for the majority group. It's for everyone. The broader question, which is an excellent question about originalism, I guess this would be my response. If we're going to go to the logical extreme of having a living constitution, we might as well not have a constitution, right? Let's just make it up as we're going along, take votes of the public and go whichever way. I'll point out to my friends the civil liberties, you shouldn't always assume this works out in the direction of civil liberties, right? We have a war on terror, we have terrorist assaults, do we really need these limitations on search and seizure? Maybe we should just get rid of those. If you don't want to go down that route, if you like stability, if you like some clarity, it seems to make a lot of sense to me to go to the text of the Constitution and say, look, this is our fundamental organic document that sets up things. And, you know, whether it makes sense to have two senators per state or should they be redistributed on the basis of population, We've had this document. It works well for us. We have to go to the text and what the text says, and this is what we have. If we don't like it, we can change it. We can amend the U.S. Constitution, right? So there is this amending process in place. The U.S. Constitution has been amended 27 times, in some cases to do really important work, to make it clear that slavery is impermissible, that African Americans are citizens, that they have rights. So we can change the U.S. Constitution in good ways. What about when the Constitution is not clear? You know, it's kind of clear, 2 senators per state, you have to be 35 to be president. These things are very clear. But there are phrases that are unclear, cruel and unusual punishment. Well, what is that exactly? Well, here's where I think it makes sense, a lot of sense to go and look at the original intent, or at least the original understanding of these words as they were ratified at the time. And this fixes their meaning so that we know what they mean. Again, there's problems with this. It's sometimes difficult to know what was meant, but sometimes it is pretty clear. So take the argument, for instance, that the death penalty is unconstitutional because it's cruel and unusual punishment. Well, clearly that position can't be supported as a matter of originalism because the Fifth Amendment clearly provides or assumes there will be the death penalty, right? It says a person's life, liberty, or property will not be taken without due process of law. So clearly the men who wrote the Bill of Rights thought the death penalty was permissible. It was not cruel and unusual punishment. Let me say as a final matter, though, let's say you're an originalist and you're on track with me, but you don't like the death penalty. What do you do? Well, the answer is basic civics. No state has to have the death penalty, right? So you can lobby the Montana legislature to abolish the death penalty. So there's still room for change, even if we say the Eighth Amendment doesn't prohibit the death penalty. If we as a society, if we as a state determine that the death penalty is bad for whatever reasons, we can get rid of it. We don't have to have it.
Last question.
Is a biblical worldview necessary for a preservation of the constitutional republic?
Wow, that's a great question. Is a biblical worldview necessary for the preservation of the Constitution? I'm going to incline to say no. As much as I would like all of our political leaders to have a biblical worldview, believe me, I would. I would rather have a president that believes in the U.S. Constitution, a president who's an atheist, who believes that his power and the national government's power is actually limited by this thing called the U.S. Constitution, that the sort of actions he can permissibly take are limited by it, and so forth, than I would to have a Christian president who embraced a living constitution. We should just make it up as we go along and do whatever ever we want. So I don't think it is, but if you ask for my preference, I would certainly and always prefer political leaders that had biblical worldviews, absolutely.
Thank you, Dr. Hull.
Thank you all very much.